Live at Scrum Australia 2014. Welcome to the Agile Revolution.
It's actually at the Agile at Scrum Australia. It's actually at the Paramount Coffee Project.
Paramount Coffee in Sydney.
The P is missing.
It's currently an extension
which
of
is,
the conference.
Yes, it is the best cafe in Sydney. So welcome to the best cafe in Sydney.
Yeah, we digress.
Craig.
Hello.
And special guest, welcome Henrik Nieberg.
Thank you.
Welcome
trying
to Australia.
Coffee for the first time in 10 years or something like that.
Cheers. New experiments today.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, we're experimenting. Short iteration.
So what brings you to Australia?
Wow, that's an interesting question. Generally prioritizing going to countries that I haven't been at in this millennium.
Well, you missed it. You did your big world tour back a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I think I got upset at you the last time I interviewed you for InfiQ because you just went to New Zealand and completely missed Australia on the trip.
Yeah, we went to New Zealand. But Australia I haven't been in for like many, many, many years. So that's one of the reasons. Plus, people keep reaching out from Sydney and Melbourne, all kinds of places in Australia. So it's cooking here. Stuff's happening. So
yeah.
I'm curious.
And into Sydney itself, what are you up to at the moment? You're keynoting?
At the conference.
Yep.
Keynoting and open spacing and hanging out with people.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing a bunch of company visits, mostly big companies,
mm-hmm.
and finding out what they're doing.
Yep.
And they're doing some touristy things and quite a mixed bag. Yeah.
So, we've spoken before, but what got you started in this whole Agile thing? I mean, what's your background and how'd you end up here?
I'm a developer. That's my background. Or I'm a musician that decided to become a developer instead of a musician.
Is that a good move or a bad move, do you think?
It's a good move, because I'm glad I don't have to actually live off of music, because that seems like a pain. So I get to play, just for fun. It's great.
So the irony of working for Spotify, I guess, is you kind of mix the two things together.
It's like coming home again. They have a studio and I'm surrounded by music people. It's great. But the background is, I'm a developer, and then I became an entrepreneur because of .com. So I was involved in a bunch of startups in the mid-90s. And then gradually some of those startups grew, and then suddenly I found myself in management and there was people all around me and I should focus on the people rather than the code. And that turned out to be quite interesting.
So I think where I sort of learned from you was the first book that you read, which was Scrum and XP from the Trenches, which to me was the first book that someone who was like me, a Scrum Master and Iteration Manager, sat down and dumped what went through their day. And I remember reading that book and going, oh my God, yes. Yeah, someone's finally got it.
Yep. Oh, coffees are here.
Coffees
yes,
are here.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to have an interlude whilst we hear Henrik drink his first coffee.
So live on the Agile Revolution, Henrik taking his first
feedback
ever coffee
loop,
in 10 years.
Sense, respond.
I am worried. Right? So my hypothesis is that I'm not going to like this, but I'm open to being proven wrong, right?
Okay, yeah.
Right.
So, sips going in.
What exactly am I drinking, by the way?
You're drinking a latte. I think it was a Costa Rican, a single origin from Seven Seeds.
How am I supposed to remember that?
So, welcome to the coffee revolution with Renee.
And I'm apparently at the best cafe in Sydney, right?
Yeah, right, definitely.
Cool. All right.
And he's taking a sip.
It's a gulp, even.
It hasn't been spat out. That's a good start.
It wasn't bad.
Okay.
But it wasn't good. It was just somewhere in between. But the experiment isn't over. Well,
you've got mine to experiment on too.
I'll finish this glass and then reserve judgment, right?
Yeah.
All right. But we also have a double macchiato that you need to experiment on just here.
I want to do, keep my whip experiment with limits for a while, so I'll get all confused with this too. So we'll let this one kind of play out. And then.
All right.
Anyway, back to
where were we? Yeah.
So, just tell us a bit about that first book. It was a changer for me, and
a changer for me too.
So what got you to kind of just sit down and start typing?
It was really just that I was a consultant in between these entrepreneurial adventures, and mostly I was kind of technical consultant, like a Java guy, come and code. And I caught myself more and more often spreading in some kind of guerrilla fashion agile techniques. Because I noticed that kind of worked in my companies that I worked at. Mostly coming from XP, because that was the one that got known first. But then at one point I actually got called in as a consultant to be interim CTO at a game company, which was a whole new type of gig. I had had that role before, but as a entrepreneur, but not as a consultant. And things were so fundamentally, absolutely broken at that company, so everybody told me anything you change will be a change for the better. It was quite nice. They said anything you change will be great. So I figured that this could be an interesting chance to try Scrum and XP together. because Scrum to me gave me a little bit of the scaling parts that I was missing from XP. So we did that, and to my big surprise, it worked better than anybody ever could have thought. It was like absolutely amazing results. So I was intrigued by that, and we kept iterating on this and experimenting a lot. So by the time I'd been there about a year, and I was going to end my engagement because things were a little bit more stable, and then I was homesick one weekend, lying in bed, and you know, sometimes when you're sick, your brain doesn't really work. But now I was actually awake in my head, but my body was kind of zonked, and I caught myself thinking about what we were doing. And thinking, oh, that's interesting, we did that, yeah, that was kind of interesting. We learned a lot. I should write it down before I forget it. It might be useful. So that was kind of the background. So I grabbed a computer and I just started looking at my photos. So I have a habit of just taking photos of stuff in my workplace, which I'm really glad for because that turned out to be useful. So I just started writing, like, here's what we're doing. It wasn't intended to be for any audience. It was just my own notes. And then I just started writing more and more. I couldn't stop. And the more I wrote, the more I started digging around in my old emails, my old photos. I thought, that's right, we did that too. That was interesting. We did that. I forgot about that. And all this stuff, so I couldn't stop. I kept writing for like a madman for 3 days, almost without stop. I fell asleep a few hours here and there. My wife came with some food sometimes, wondering what the heck I'm doing.
Like, yeah, I thought you were sick.
So after about 3 days, believe it or not, the whole book was pretty much done. Everything except the chapter on the... on distributed teams and scaling, I think, the last two chapters. So yeah, that was the story. I have this big, huge article which I didn't know what the heck to do with. So I put an email on the Scrum mailing list, like, what do I do with this? And people were like, this is good, you should spread it. Mike Cohn said, you have two options now, Henrik. You can publish a book. It won't be as widely spread, but you'll get good credit, right? It's good credit writing a book. Or you can just put it out for free, and it'll spread a lot faster, but you don't get as many, you know, like, kind of cool credit points, right? So I found InfoQ somehow. I don't know how. Someone recommended it, and they, you know, provided both. I could make a book that people can buy if they want to, and they can also download for free. So that sounded perfect. Plus, they let me pretty much put it up in the current state without wanting to change a lot of stuff. I was a bit lazy, just wanted to get it out. And then it went totally crazy viral. I never would have expected it. Even today, like 8 years later, it's still
people
somewhat
viral.
People
are fed
viral.
Of it, yeah, of course.
It's scary, I shouldn't have done it.
Well, it's free.
Well, it's not only that, but it's also how it's written. It's to me, and I think I would highlight that it's everything that you write, and even everything that you do in your videos, and experiencing how you talk over the last couple of days, in person, you are exactly like you're writing. which dumbfounds me, and I'm awe-inspired by the way in which you're able to so succinctly simplify messaging.
That's interesting. Maybe that's just the way I like to work. Like, I want to understand stuff, and sometimes I think it simmers in the back of my head for a while. I'm wondering, why the heck did this work? Why did this not work? And then it's sitting there for a while, and then at some point it gets kind of clear, and then I try to quickly write it down before I forget it.
Yeah.
And then nowadays I've gotten better at it because at the time I wrote that, I never did any talks anywhere. I didn't even know of the existence of Agile conferences, right? But after I wrote that thing, then I started getting invited to conferences. And then I had to start thinking more about how do I present this message, manager's role in Scrum or test automation. So it became a bit of a hobby to think about things. And then once in a while, something gets clear and then write it down quickly. And then when you do talks, you practice it, right? So every time I do a talk, it gets more and more clear.
Craig, in my case, maybe once or twice for practice. Yeah.
But it's scary too, because I'm a little bit worried of what can happen is if I were to, for example, do too many talks, it would get more and more clear in my head. After a while, it would become false clear. It would become, I would start believing what I'm saying too much.
And does it?
And lose connection to reality.
Does it?
What?
Does it happen now?
No, because now I work, like, I'm always a couple of days per week, I'm with real companies.
Right. Okay.
What I'm worried about is if I become this guy that's only teaching and talking and not actually being in the trenches.
Yep.
Then after a while, you start forming your own theories and you start believing what you're saying and you're iterating on last year's thought. And after a while, it becomes an introvert kind of way of understanding things.
Otherwise known as ivory tower syndrome.
Ivory tower syndrome, yeah. And you can get really good at describing crap in a very believable way if you don't have connections to reality. And you can trick a lot of people into doing a lot of dumb things by just being very good at saying, hey, you know, this thing waterfall, right? You should clarify the requirements, obviously, because otherwise you don't know what you're doing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it works.
And only when the requirements are done would you do design, because then everything's stable, right? And testing, why would you retest all the time? Test at the end when everything is finished, right? You only need to test once. You can probably make
really
a beautiful
sensible.
Case of waterfall.
You heard it first. Henrik is an advocate of waterfall.
Welcome to the waterfall regulation. This
is
great.
The new thing, right? Yeah, the Agile is so 2000, right? So yeah, okay, keep one foot in reality.
We've got a title for the podcast now.
The book that I find this big misapprehension about Kanban, and whilst David J. Anderson wrote the book on that, the blue book, your book's the one I always recommend, because if I want someone to read it, at least they can go download it for free,
it's free.
but the second thing is that the people often, the leap that they're trying to make is they've already kind of heard about this this Scrum thing or this Agile thing, and makes the leap. And my selling point to them is, and it's got pictures.
And a cartoon even.
The walls, right? It takes people through on a very visual sense of that. And so, what was the impetus behind that book?
That was also another article that went wild, right? It was just an article. And for some reason, we decided to do the InfoQ thing again, maybe because the first one was... The thing is, when an article gets too long, it's not fun to read on a screen. You want something physical. Mm. And who wants to print 50 pages, right? So what I like about InfoQ is it's still free, because there's not a lot of monetary incentive in selling books. At the end of the day, it's other things that earn your money, right? Even if you're a really good, successful author. So the royalties are really not so important. Mm. So putting out books for free, I think, is great. You spread the message. Mm. But then it's good for people to be able to get a book in their hand. So that's what I like about InfoQ. But the background to that was really specifically that situation. I noticed when I wrote Scrum and XP from the Trenches, I noticed that there was two camps, like Scrum and XP, like tribes kind of throwing ties at each other. And
we've talked about it a few times.
Now it's Kanban and Scrum.
So I had just gone through this experience of fusion, right? Scrum and XP together was beautiful. So I wanted to bridge this gap. So I put both those buzzwords in the title. And it's kind of like repeating that trick, because I noticed that, okay, Scrum and XP, they're friends now. Mm. Kanban and Scrum are kind of jealous enemies at the time. Not as bad, I think. But,
no, I agree, yeah.
So I wanted to bridge that gap, because I noticed, these are just toolkits to me. Use whatever fits. Mm. So that was the background. Plus what you just said, that most people at the time, Scrum was pretty big and Kanban was quite new. Mm. So I wanted to provide a frame of reference for understanding what it is.
Yeah.
But then I'm glad David wrote his book, because mine doesn't go very deep. It's on the surface, right?
Yeah.
So his book provides a depth.
Yeah, I think yours is the one I like when I'm teaching an introductory class, that it can get people more excited about it, because you talk about it for an hour, it's about all you have in a class. People go, I want to know more. Yeah. And so I'll say to them, well, there's the book you should read, but if you just want to get into it, go find this.
It's like the risk when you pick up a book like mine, the risk is you might think, oh, come on, it's just sticky notes and whip limits, right? But if you go a bit deeper, it's important to see the whole kind of value stream, this perspective and systems thinking thing.
Cool. So it's interesting that you might use the analogy like two's company, three's a crowd here. So when you get Scrum and XP together, I'm curious about whether adding Kanban in makes it a bit of a crowd, but also knowing your approach.
Common enemy kind of thing?
I don't know. I guess at more your Spotify as an approach, it sounds to me like you have more of a blended sort of framework of not even just three, maybe four or five different things just all thrown into the mix. I know you've got a lot of lean startup influence inside of there.
But we got like 25 coaches that are all, they all have their pet frameworks that they're interested in.
Mm.
The flavor of the month kind of thing. So we like trying things.
So how does that work out when you've got, ultimately it sounds like 25 different approaches to how you work. If teams go from area to area, or do they just stay together?
I guess the thing that provides some stability is the culture.
Yep.
In a sense, so if I go from one team to another, okay, maybe they do sprints differently, or maybe they don't do sprints. The layout of their board is going to be different.
Yep.
And maybe some of the tools are different. But a lot is the same, right? It's the fact that they're a small cross-functional team with end-to-end responsibility, the fact that they have visual management and daily meetings, the fact that they have a coach. So I would say there's still more similarities than differences. And the differences are more on the surface.
And so what does that mean at a management layer? Because I know that a lot of people are concerned, especially in Australia, that they want to standardise so that, if a manager wants to attend a Scrum, there's consistency and there's not confusion, and they can actually understand what on earth teams are doing without being confused about how and if they're working. How have you tackled that?
Basically, to me, that's optimizing for the wrong thing. Like, the goal, the purpose of the organization is not to make life easy for the manager.
Yep.
It's to make it possible to deliver and learn fast. So it's more like I see it as, in order to optimize for the teams to deliver, we sacrifice a little bit. And one thing we sacrifice is the ability for the manager to see exactly what's going on. And in fact, I see that as a dysfunction. If you have a manager that has to see everything that's going on, that's like a symptom of lack of trust or an anti-pattern. But nevertheless, you do need a bit of that. So sometimes we have this notion of, I have no idea what's happening, right? So we're experimenting a lot with what's the least amount of visual management we can add that doesn't cause micromanagement. And that's a trade-off.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your talk there's quite a lot of trade-offs.
Yeah.
So walk us through some of those that you see on a day-to-day basis.
I guess one biggie is consistency versus flexibility. So on the one end of the scale, we might say consistency in terms of like tool. Let's say we all use the same backlog management tool. That's very consistent. It's nice. But whatever we choose, it's going to suck for a number of teams because it's one single tool and teams have slightly different needs. So that's generally not a good solution, having everyone use exactly the same tool. But to go to the other end of the scale, if we have 70 squads and they use 70 different tools, that gets really crazy and messy. So some kind of balance. What's just enough consistency? Another example is recently we decided to move to one version control system instead of two. We never decided to have to. It just happened that way because of autonomy. And everybody kind of assumed we would converge to one, but it took longer than we ever would have thought.
Yeah.
So at some point, we came to the realization that we actually have to, we should standardize now. We can't just wait for cross-pollination to work. Yeah. So normally, cross-pollination does the job. You just wait for the best tool will spread to the people who need it. And people who don't like that tool will use something different. That's normally okay. But in this particular case, we made a little push to say, okay, we all agree that we should have one. We won't find one that everybody loves, but we all agree that there should be one. So,
and you treat that just like a blocker? I mean, is that because, you know, you and the other coaches are wandering around the corridors and you kind of, you know, you observe it or you hear it, and then at some point, like a good scrum master does, actually goes, now it's time to bubble that up.
Yeah, it keeps popping up. It's I wouldn't say it's a major blocker. It's more a minor annoyance, but it adds up over time, accumulates over time. But also that it's just a minor annoyance, but it adds up. And there's a lot of people impacted by it.
I think the highlight of that particular story too, and you're referring to your Git versus GitHub analogy, was that it was a grassroots-based movement. It wasn't a manager that came in that said, this is a problem. This is someone that actually felt quite acutely the pain.
Yeah.
And then sort of stepped up, did a lot of data sourcing on how people were using
the systems. Yeah, he had a pretty simple approach.
Which version people preferred, and given that, really just made a decision. Didn't have the authority, but was completely empowered to be able to do that.
He gathered the data, presented the data, and pretty much him and a few other people, who, as far as I know, didn't have any formal authority to make a decision like this. They just announced the decision.
and get through endless meetings.
I haven't heard anyone complain. More like they're happy. I'm glad this happened. I'm a bit disappointed it didn't happen earlier, kind of thing. But so that's, I think that's a good example.
To me, it's a really great example. You know, you have organizations that have something in their secret sauce that makes them special. And no matter how much someone tries to replicate to be like them, no matter how much you try and apply a lot of the elements that you talk about inside of Spotify, if you don't have the culture, and to me, Spotify's secret sauce is around autonomy and empowerment.
Yeah.
If you don't have that, you're unlikely to succeed.
I guess you'd have to use different ways of succeeding, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, there are lots of companies that succeed anyway, despite having a different culture.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I mean, it's succeed in replicating what you have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How vibrant was the culture when you turned up, you know, 3-4 years ago, whenever it was that you showed up? I mean, because you read the paper now and you go, wow, that's awesome. But I assume that, you know, there was work needed to... To get them to grow up a little bit.
I've worked, my first contact with the company was, I think, 2008, which was by accident. I did a talk at the university and the Royal Institute of Technology, which is where I studied.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also where many of the founders or the first Spotify developers came from.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a group of people at that talk that were very, you know, had a lot of very difficult, complex questions. And they were very, like, almost rabid, like they wanted to have answers to these questions. How do I handle multiple teams? How do I do this? How do I do that? I was like besieged by questions. Turned out later, I didn't know at the time, but it turned out later that those were the kind of first Spotify
people.
Yeah. So they had just gotten to the point where the first product was getting done, and they were starting to get enough people, like 20 or whatever, that they had to have some kind of structure. So they were thirsty for some kind of way of structuring things, not just being an ad hoc startup, right? And what they told me a year later was that this fit them perfectly. So they just took it. Said, let's do this. This is our way of working. And so they became like pretty much a Scrum-based company because my talk was about Scrum.
Mm.
But what I noticed, then later on they called me in sometimes just to help sort some things out, like how do we handle multiple teams. So I came in kind of maybe once or twice per year just to do some workshops. And only the past 3 years have I been there more continually. So now I'm there half time. But the culture to me has always been fundamentally quite healthy. Like I haven't seen very many of the kind of stupid problems that I sometimes see in other places. Most of their problems are, they make sense. Like, okay, it makes sense that we'd have this problem in this condition. So it's not so much me trying to walk around with a machete to cut down bureaucracy. It's more like, okay, we have a complicated problem here or a complex problem and we'll solve it. Yeah, we've been talking about Kinevin here. And I think that culture was largely formed by the mindset of the founders and the first few people who came in, which is maybe random, I don't know, but that has a big impact.
It's interesting, I guess you talk about that and you look at Spotify from the outside just as a user and its popularity, and I'm not sure where it sits in the, it would have to be in the top three, if not number one, as the streaming service. I mean, surely there has to be something attributed to the fact that its popularity is linked to the way software is developed. Because a lot of people take that for granted.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I'm pretty convinced that the reason why the product is fundamentally good, it's succeeding quite well in just pretty much all market. In Sweden, it's just ubiquitous. People don't even know how to use any. You can listen to music at Spotify. Period. Mm. Right. But I think it's the people in the company really care about doing that. It's passion. They come to Spotify because they really want to make this work.
Mm.
The downside to it, which is interesting now, is that people who, the first hires at Spotify and the founders, they just, like most entrepreneurs, they're not doing it because they want to get rich, they want to do it because there's an itch to scratch, there's a problem that needs to be solved, right? And that's the focus. Which means, in that case, since they're lucky enough to be building a product where they are the customer as well, right, they can make a lot of good decisions. However, that's biting us a little bit now, because now we have like 1,500 people or something, and they're expert users of the product. And the customers we want to reach are like the 6 billion people in the world that don't know what the heck Spotify is. And some of them don't even know what, they've never used any kind of product like this. They are the perspective, the focus, right?
People like me that still buy CDs.
Yeah. So if you have...
Like you said it the other day, I'm going, I'm one of those people that still buy CDs.
So the hard thing is, you got these people who, their personal problem is, how do I organize my 100 playlists? But the problem they need to solve for the users are, how do I even start listening to anything? So that's our challenge now, to kind of, we got user researchers in, to basically help the developers build empathy for who their real users are.
That's a real problem, because you've got to keep the users you've got, because as soon as they see new shiny thing over here, new people who are new to a product will obviously be the ones that'll go to the next thing, which I think is testament, because Spotify still holds up despite the thousands of different services that have come in. But then, as you say, you've got this many billion people, but there's so many more billion people like Renee who haven't don't even know what a streaming service is.
But the thing about, I think, really helps a lot is the management. They have these town halls that we meet on a regular basis where they go up and they hold these inspiring speeches. And I always get really inspired by them, because it's very much storytelling. They're telling a story of our journey. So here we are now, right? And here's our big thing now. Here's where we think we're going. And sometimes there's pivoting involved. Sometimes there's like hard challenges. Like we now have Google and Apple as competitors. Like, right? What are we going to do? So it's very inspiring. People are always being shown where we are in the big narrative, and that helps people to think about the product itself and not so much of this little function here, I'm going to make it really pretty and I don't care about the users, right? And I think that shows through the product.
So whilst we're talking about Spotify, and I'm not quite sure, like, if you don't feel comfortable answering this question, I'm going to ask a contentious one. So my understanding is, as an organization right now, it's still not making a profit as far as cost versus profit, is that correct?
I promise to pay for it at some point in the future.
So the way it works, there's two revenue streams. There's ads, and there's a premium, right?
Right.
And right now Spotify is growing.
Yes.
So their focus isn't profit.
Yes.
I don't have the data, but I'm pretty sure that if they would decide to focus on profits, all they would probably need to do is just stop growing. And just sit in Sweden and rake in the money, fire half the company, right? And just sit there and earn money.
Yeah.
But that's not their goal, because if they just stop, they're going to be overrun by competitors. So So this industry is a little bit like, you look at Google, you look at Facebook, there's just one winner, and it's global. So, and it's a network thing, because people want to be on the platform where their friends are. Listeners want to be where the artists are. Artists want to be where the listeners are. So it's right now, it's kind of like, okay, we got a momentum. We're kind of winning the race right now. And we either stop and die, or we become the worldwide number one leader in this. So it's aggressive focus on growth, which implies that we can't be optimizing for short-term profit. Instead, it's optimizing for users loving the product.
Yeah. So I guess there's people out there that think, well, why not should we do Spotify as a model? Because, and I know that you never take that approach. I know that you're the sort of person that says, look, this is just how I do it. Look, you're welcome to do it the same way if you want, but this is how I do it. But a lot of people think, well, why should we emulate Spotify if they're not making a profit? And I guess when I heard you talk about it the other day, you were referring to the fact that you just wanted to be... you think you're in for the long term to be number one, and you sort of likened it to how there's only one search engine that anyone uses these days, and that you see the music industry going into a similar sort of pattern as well, where it's going to be one big player, and you're fighting some big guys as a result.
I guess also if you look at that, if your goal is short, I mean, of course, a company has to survive, right? But it depends a little bit on what state it's in. If you take a company like Google or Facebook in the early days, and they start optimizing for short-term profit, it probably wouldn't be around today. Right? What those companies were doing, they're optimizing for building a product that everybody loves to use. And once you get to that point, yes, there are ways of monetizing these things once you have a product that everybody loves to use. So you take pretty much any really well-known product that is turning a big profit, at some point in the beginning, probably, they were optimizing for something else than short-term
profit. But I think the thing I'd highlight, it's not a once you get to that point. It's an if you get to that point.
Yeah, even if you get to
that point. And there's so many potential startups out there that have the opportunity to get it big.
Yeah.
But so few do.
And I think another thing is also, there's two parts of it. One is, do we have a business model that is viable? And second is, are we turning a profit, right?
Mm.
Like, I was involved in a dot-com startup, which was like all fluff, right? Just like many dot-com startups in the early 2000s. It was all fluff. We were going to take over the world, but we had no actual business model. So when the wall hit us, which is probably a good thing, we had to fire a lot of people and shut down a lot of products. And we kept only one, which was the one that was actually had a business model, which turned a profit. So I think the key thing there, which I think is important, is Spotify has a business model. We have a way of earning money for people. What worries me is sometimes when companies, they have no idea of how they even might earn money on this thing. And that's a bigger risk, right?
Yes. So you get... And if people haven't read the paper on Spotify, I should go and read it about the squads and tribes and
all the videos.
The
videos are more fresh, they're newer. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you mentioned in your talk that there's 70 squads in there, and you don't have the role of a scrum master, you have the role of an agile coach,
which is roughly equivalent.
So one of the problems I see in a lot of large organizations in this country is you just can't get enough people that have experience to be a scrum master or an agile coach. So how did you go about scaling that? Was it bringing in a few people like yourself and others who had experience, and then sort of bringing people up who were...
it was pretty gradual. I think they hired the first agile coach somewhere around 2010, if I remember correctly. And then they just had one for a while, and she started hiring a few more. So it was quite gradual. It wasn't like, bang, we're going to get 25 coaches. And yes, it is hard. I mean, we're pretty picky, and a lot of people get rejected. So it's hard. And as a result, we don't have coaches for all squads. We have about 20, 25, maybe 30. So each coach has two or three squads.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always a challenge. So people handle it differently. In some cases, a coach will have two or three squads, and they'll try to manage that. In some cases, a coach will simply focus on one or two and just ignore one and say, you guys, you'll manage fine without me, right? In some cases, they do a pooling. This is relatively new, but in some tribes, it's like, so we have three coaches, and let's just not have, you know, this is my squad and that's yours. Mm. Let's go where we need to be. I don't know what the right approach is, but what I do know is it's turned out hugely valuable to have people with a coach role. And I think that's kind of a good example of how a company like this invests in the culture. Because these are culture workers in a sense, right? Mm. They're not expected to produce code and produce the product. So that's a direct result of actually putting money on the table and saying, we're investing in culture, we're having people here who just try to help other people get effective.
And I think that's why I get hung up sometimes on people saying, is a scrum master a full-time role? And I always come back to, well, it can be if you can show that you're adding value. And when you see the model that you've got, that is ideally it's where it's adding value, because
you can see it.
Actually, in the past, if you'd asked me 3 or 4 years ago, I would have, you know, people ask about the Scrum Master part-time role. What I used to tell people is it's best to have, you know, it's normally not full-time if the team is working quite well, but I recommend having just one team. I used to say that, right? Because you have one team, you have one context, and when you're not Scrum Mastering, then you're coding or testing, whatever you can do. Spotify approach is a little different then, right? Because we have full-time coaches. They're just part-time in each squad, right? But the role, they're full-time. And it's the first time I've seen that work, and it works quite well. So I don't know if it's, I guess it's contextual.
I think it's a cultural thing, because if you're doing the other way around, you're very much in a system or an organization that's trying to move from a very traditional approach.
Could be.
And that's why you need that role. When you've got more that culture, I agree with you.
It's multitasking in both cases, but it's different types of multitasking. So when you're in a team, I'm multitasking the role, right? I'm coding one day, and next day I'm Scrum Mastering. Well, in the context of Spotify, it's more like a multitasking between different squads. And that, now my inclination is, it seems to work better in the sense that I think it's just very hard to multitask which role you have.
It'd be interesting to see, though, if it was someone who was more entrenched in Scrum than what Spotify was, whether they could make the leap from that across to that kind of role, particularly people growing up with the Scrum model.
Yeah.
So you've just released your second video.
Yeah, finally.
Finally. I won't talk about the third one because I'll get in trouble again.
Right.
Maybe April 1st, but that could be an April Fool's. You take it as you will, listeners. So what's next for you?
So my planning horizon right now is quite short. I'm planning on taking a break January, February, March, doing a Slack quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Which is spending more time with kids and being home and maybe catching up on writing some articles and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's my plan right now. So it's pretty much just surviving until then. At Spotify right now, I have some projects, some experiments that are running that I want to follow up on, see how they pan out. And then I have a few short trips, actually just one more after this one. I'm going to Hamburg. Various little things. So far, I've been trying to be quite focused on Spotify, but this last quarter, I've lacked a little bit in my discipline, or I've been a little bit too excited by some of the clients that I've gotten in contact. So I'm now working with some other companies in Stockholm, just short visits, but very interesting companies. So I'll be doing a little bit of helping some of those companies at least get started with the change program, and then try not to get too entangled, but yeah, wish me luck.
And I guess that probably brings me along to the question is that the other part, which I find incredibly interesting, is the whole CRISP model. So like you're just talking about building in Slack to the to your process. I guess your whole personal business, which is your company CRISP, is kind of built around that the model where you can build in Slack if you want. You can go and work from multiple if you want. You can pretty much do what you want.
Yes, CRISP is an interesting. It's a consulting company. We're about 35 people, and we're trying to find the sweet spot between being independence with 100% freedom, but not so much network and not so much platform or security. So being completely independent isn't all that great. Most of us have that background. And being an employee, we don't much like that either because we're very, very big on freedom. We're kind of addicted to freedom, right? We don't want to have a manager. We don't want to have to ask for permission to do stuff, right? So CRISP is an attempt to find the sweet spot. So 30 people that do have a company, who do have a platform. But to us, CRISP is a runtime environment for consultants, kind of, right? So it's just a place for us to share some notes, learn from each other, share some costs, build a common brand, and that's pretty much it. But it's an interesting experiment. Yeah, CRISP is a whole topic of its own, which is very interesting.
Yeah, indeed, indeed.
Some of my friends say, bloody hippie company, anarchists, right? But but it's working. We've experimented a lot, and now we found a way which we actually like. It's working.
Well, you're traveling around the world and paying your mortgage, and your kids are growing up. That's all you really need, right?
So one of the things I love about some of the language you use, you talk a lot about experimentation, and you're not really referring to necessarily like the way in which you work is obviously experiment with customers through a lean startup sort of focus, but you're also experimenting on process, which is something that I guess we've been doing for a very long time, is looking at the way in which we're working with teams as coaches to say, it's never set in stone. Does that mean that you're a big supporter of the Oath of Non-Allegiance?
Yeah, I'm a big supporter of the Oath of Non-Allegiance.
It's a mouthful
of words, so I can't repeat it. But it's something about not judging ideas based on where they came from, but on the merits of the idea itself.
Yep.
My metaphor is always the toolboxes. I think of myself as I come in to a company with some toolboxes.
Yep.
And I want the toolbox to be as big as possible. I want to have as many different tools as possible. And there's two key skills. One is how each tool works. and the second is deciding which tool is appropriate for the moment, kind of thing. So I try to build that skill.
How important do you think it is, so I was talking, I think it was yesterday, you said you come from a developer background, and I was talking, I think, at dinner the other night, and you were talking about CRISP, and you said, when we're looking for people, we're looking for new skill sets, so...
Yeah.
One of the traps I see people who join this community fall into is that, I mean, you have to do your 10,000 hours of practice to do what we do, right? You know, we've lived and breathed it for so long.
Yeah.
But what about the background, right? So you can code and you do. You've got the little projects on the side where you do that. Some people have DevOps. How important is that, having a skill set that you can relate to the team, to being a good coach, do you think?
So let's see, that was a bunch of questions. I'll just grab the last one.
that was a whole part to get to the question.
Okay. Yeah. So how important is it if I'm a team that I can relate to their craft?
Yes.
Right? So having a craft as well as being a coach.
Right. So I find it really important to have some relationship to it. I think a person who has no experience in software development at all in any kind of role, I think wouldn't make the best coach, at least a Scrum Master type. If they're a really good coach, you might compensate for it.
Mm.
But I think there is value in having some understanding of the context. If nothing else, because you'll get more respect from the team. Right? They'll listen to you more. With that said, I think it can be dangerous if you're too into coding or if you're too into your craft, because you might start meddling, right?
Mm.
You might start, move over, let me write that code, right? So it's a balance.
Mm.
But I have seen some coaches that struggle because they can't speak the language of the people they're coaching.
Mm. I just see a lot of people who fall into the Scrum Master role particularly kind of go, great, I can kind of do this and I don't have to focus on a craft anymore.
Yeah.
And that concerns me, because at some point if we decide that we don't need the Scrum Master thing anymore, then what are you going to go and fall back on?
And also I think it's important to have multiple perspectives on that. So it's like, I wouldn't want somebody who has no experience in software development, and I'd also maybe avoid somebody who has only experience of one thing, like only coding. The most valuable, I think, is if you have a little bit of experience of product management, for example, and maybe a bit of coding, just two or three different things, because then you're less likely to get blinded by all problems are coding problems, right? Or all problems are backlog problems, right? You start realizing there's other categories of problems that are maybe even outside of my competence area.
Yeah.
So let me find someone who can help me with that. I guess you become more open to your blind spots.
So I'm pretty sure we're close to out of time. Yes, I can't see the time from here.
We could go another hour here.
Yeah,
it's fun.
I'm sure we're gonna put the links to your books and to your videos up on the site as well.
Absolutely.
But I do want to thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And for talking to us today. And if people want to contact you, what's the best way for them to contact you?
Probably drop an email. If you're creative enough, you'll find it online.
Okay, well, go find, apparently.
Go Google now.
or tweet me or something.
What's the Twitter?
What?
What's the Twitter handle?
Just my name. Yeah.
Excellent.
So, feel free to get in touch. I answer if and when I have time.
We have 3 months of Slack coming up, so there you go.
All right. But I actually enjoy. Sometimes people drop in emails, short questions, or just personal experiences.
Yep.
Like, hey, I read your paper, we tried it, this is what happened. Always interesting. Yeah.
Awesome.
Been great to catch up. We said we followed your work from the very early days, and it's like a channel. So every time I read your book, I go, yes, he got down what I was thinking on paper. So it's awesome to have you out here and sharing the squadification model as well. So I think that was an eye-opener, particularly for a lot of people in the conference yesterday who maybe had just heard about it, but digging into it was really powerful.
Yeah, it's been the same as when I wrote this Chronic Script in the Trenches. I wrote it because I needed it, and then it became viral, and I was kind of surprised.
Mm.
Same thing with the Spotify thing. I wrote it because I wanted to understand, and more used it for internal use.
Mm.
And then it went crazy viral in a way that I never could have expected. So it's weird. It's interesting.
I think more in the Agile community can learn from that.
Yep. Yeah. And you're always welcome back to Australia as well.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right.
And now, how was the coffee?
That was terrible.
So I got to it. So here's the thing. Wait.
So finish the experiment now.
Experiment finished. I would say on a scale of 1 to 5.
I don't know which way the scale is going here.
Where 1 means horrible.
Right.
Take you to a hospital. And 5 means, oh man, give me another one. 3 means meh, right?
Yeah.
It's a 3.
Okay.
So if a coffee is in front of me, I'll drink it. I probably won't order it.
I'll give it a 3.5.
Yeah, 3.5.
It's more than meh for me, because that's what most coffee is. That was pretty good coffee. But yes, if we're going to order another one, I'm going to...
But it's a step up, because in the past, coffee has always been a 2 for me. So this is a 3. That's a big difference.
Huge. All right.
So he's not going to convert to coffee. We know that. You've heard it here first.
And I never got around to trying yours, so yeah.
I know, because it was so tiny. It was going to get cold by the time that you drink it.
Anyway,
so if you want to contact us, you can contact me at Renee@TheAgileRevolution or...
Craig@TheAgileRevolution.
Thank you for listening. Viva La Revolution.
Bye-bye.